Mr. James, Reel 20. Right, Mr. James, we're still in Winchelsea, and we're talking about various exercises that you were involved in, and you had a story off the tape about the Home Guard and some of their...
That's right. When we took over the town, the village, the Home Guard handed over to us certain items of equipment. The spigot mortars were the ones that I remember particularly. They were enormous, great, big, old-fashioned mortars. And, oh God almighty, what are we going to do with these? But anyway, that was part of the Home Guard's equipment. It seems to me that when we arrived at Winchelsea, the Home Guard said goodbye. And, you know, they stood down, I think. And that was the end of their activities there. But they forgot to hand over to us certain things which I discovered quite by accident. Right opposite the New Inn pub, there's a corner house and garden. And we took the house over for accommodation and went into the garden, and to my surprise, the whole of the back garden had hundreds of phosphorus bombs in the garden, left it by the Home Guard. They were part of the Home Guard of First Line of Defense things, you know.
Could you describe what these things looked like and how big
they were? They were like square pickle jars. They were big, square jars, glass jars, filled with water. And inside the water was a stick of phosphorus submerged in the water. If, of course, this phosphorus was exposed to the air, it would immediately ignite. And that was the way the bomb worked. But anyway, they were damn dangerous. Because these, there were hundreds of them in this back garden, kept as a stock for soldiers or Home Guard to herd up to every tax, obviously. Well, it was frightening to see the state of some of these bombs, you know. It's one that didn't go off because the water was getting lower and evaporating, and we had to do something about it quick. So I remember telling the commander about my find, and he went up and he was very, very concerned, and I think he reported to the battalion, and eventually they were never removed. They were never removed, but I think that they were topped up by somebody with water and maintained, but we didn't take them over, and they weren't part of our defence. But they were there, and they were there all the time. We were in Winchelsea.
Do you have any contact? Was the Home Guard in evidence?
Totally. When they handed over these big mortars. And they were the old boys, you know, who said, well, this is what we've got to have over to you. And I remember particularly, I'd never seen them before in life. They were very, very crude, enormous mortars. And did take away the ammunition, but took off the spirit mortars and handed them into the QM. God knows where he probably handed it over to the Home Guard was still down at that time. The invasion of Russia, I think, began, and the crisis was over.
Did you have any other troops in the village apart from the DLI?
No, I cannot remember any other troops at all in the village.
What about anti-aircraft?
They were in Rye, or it was outside, but they were not in the village. We didn't have any aircraft in the village, but we know they were very far away, and of course they certainly were in Lynn, a Dutch mess, where we could slip across the water a few miles. We could see the coastal defences along there, so they would be over there, you know, the attack, but no attack guns in Winchelsea.
During this period, there was a large number of so-called hit-and-run raids by German fighters on the south coast.
Right.
Do any incidents spring to mind during your time in Winchelsea?
Well, I remember there was one particular incident, because they used to come over and they used to sort of... there was a gun emplacement in Lid, where... I'm not sure, I think it was some of the soldiers of our battalion who were there with the detachment. And they were supposed to sort of fire the brand if a fighter came over. One particular sergeant didn't, and he got busted.
Can you remember who that was?
I can't remember. I cannot remember. But there was an incident over at Lid where this brand didn't go into action against this fighting. He would have been a silly duck. And nobody's mad at him.
And was he a DLI man, or would he be...
Well, I'm wondering whether he was a DLI man or not. They were quite a way over from us. If they were one or two, I can't remember the name of the company over there. So I don't think they could have been hard, because I know that the military were all along the river canal. You know, that was the direction towards the Indian Nest. And there were all sorts of REs and people like that, you know, in the area. Could have been Royal Engineers.
So, have you got any specific memories of German aircraft at this time?
Yes, I've got memories of German aircraft fighters, but we didn't seem to, anybody. We took it as a matter of a normal thing.
So how, what would happen, I mean, in a normal day when you had an air raid, how would it?
Well, if a fighter came over, he'd probably be in between Winchelsea and Dunsinane, something like that. We didn't even take cover. And we watch on. I mean, nobody ever took any pot to my knowledge anyway. Nobody took any pot shots just at my bit on my arms in Winchelsea. But I remember particularly one crippled British fighter plane coming back from France or somewhere, flying low and obviously in trouble. And the ICAC from somewhere opened up and hit the plane and shut it down. One day it was a hurricane, limping home. And this hurricane, I rather think, came down somewhere over near Bert Newman's store. I think that he eventually dived into the River Rother Mud, and it took about 10 days to dig the poor chap out. And when they dug him out, he was covered from head to toe in shrimps.
Mm.
And I thought, oh my God, look at that. Well, you know, I didn't see it particularly, but the news came back to me on the very day that we dug him out. And the River Rother Mud.
Was there any, the battalion history talks of Bert Newman's stores being bombed, his coal store. Do you know anything about that?
No, well, of course, he was very dry. I didn't get a slip trench, outside his store. We used to call him Slip Trench Bert. He survived so long. Even wherever he was, he had the first thing he did, he had a slip trench down at the side of where he was. Oh, he was a real soldier, he was. He never took any chances at all, I can tell you that. And that's one thing we had against him, actually. We thought, all right, for you, mate. You just left no time at all. We didn't see a helmet on. Took no chances whatsoever. He was well trained. But I wouldn't surprise me if he did have something dropped the enemy.
What about the RAF at this stage? Was their presence felt?
No, I didn't see, or we weren't any bothered with the RAF. We didn't see any Winchelsea anyway. And I dare say that something would have been implied. As I said, the first 2 weeks from Fort Simulacre, I had the great pleasure, I enjoyed it, of being in Rye and attending one of the dances there. It was a very nice place to be in, and we made lots of friends. I'm a bit sorry, initially, that I was sent out of Winchelsea, you know, because I had made one or two friends.
So there would have been more of a mix at the dances at Rye, would there be RAF and...
I think so, that's right. I think so as well. There were some airfields, I think, just a little way out of Rye, northwards. I think, and there were some fighter stations as well.
And you were making the point off the tape that at the dances you had at Winchelsea, everybody would be in khaki.
Everybody was military. The ATS girls with their skirts and stockings. They used to sort of look a bit glamorous. We would put on the ATS thick khakis and stockings. They'd have some nylons from somewhere, you know.
And would the ATS women, would they have a collar and tie?
They did.
Even the privates?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. How would you feel at one of these dances as, sergeants and below, you would have the button-up battle dress, and you wouldn't have
Yes, well, there was a time, you see, later on, don't think it happened, actually. I got a photograph of myself. We had our own pattern dresses modified.
Yeah, but this is later. This is.
And we had reverse on.
But at this stage, in 1942, you wouldn't have a collar and tie. You would have the battle dress buttoned up.
I think that my photograph, which is about 1942, shows me with my battle dress open and collar and tie. I've got one. I've got a photograph somewhere of myself with the battle dress handing out to me.
Right.
But that was very late on.
So it's probably later than this. In terms of the exercises and schemes, so at whatever level, you'd be really protected from those in terms of having to do the route marches.
I would be allowed to let them get on with it, and I would be probably filling in returns and getting stuff to Bert Newman, and he was a set of the occupation.
So every scheme and exercise would more or less be the same.
That's
for you.
That's right. And I remember particularly, you know, I would be aware of it, but I, at CKMS, would not go on them unless there were meals to be provided on them.
Do you remember anything about the battalion efficiency competition that took place in late 42 with Colonel Ware?
Very vaguely.
Well, he had to march 10 miles in 2 hours.
Yeah, it was very vague. I wasn't on that even. But I remember particularly that there was some rivalry, some intercompany rivalry. That's right. But when Dickie Ware was with us.
Because it was Arthur Pearson's company, C Company, that won that competition.
Yeah, I got surprised.
And it was one of his platoons that was...
That's right, yes, and I got surprised. I suppose your father as well would have been in that, wouldn't he? And wouldn't have been aware of it. But I do remember vaguely that. We had, at the time, of course, Charlie really remembered that very well as well, because he would be actively engaged in that sort of thing. And, the office staff usually, including a professional footballer in our company office, under George Porter, whose name was Osborne. He was a very nice, friendly chap. And Charlie Bain remembers him more than I do. But I mean, I remember him. I do remember him. He was the first one mentioned of Charlie Bain when we got in touch again on the phone. Osborne. And Dave was excused as well, the company clerk.
What about the bikes? Did the bikes take part in these exercises?
If the bikes were involved, they were there for operational duties. They were there to get the troops quickly down to the lower road where the sea was, or Winchelsea beaches. You wouldn't, you know, you went down marching from Winchelsea down through the various openings on the way to Hastings, and you go down, and you could come down to the lower road. You wouldn't be aware of the sea. It was as if it was, you wouldn't know that up that little mound there, over the top of that little mound there, there was the seaside. You wouldn't know it. You wouldn't even hear it because you're down low. But if you climbed the bank, went up, you'd be surprised. Deep shingle beach going for a long way down to the sea.
But in terms of like exercises like Harold, would the bikes be involved in that? Or would
no, they were not, because of course that was an exercise on mobility over far away.
You mentioned off the tape the special orders that the bikes that the NCO had to learn. Can you remember any of
that? There was a drill to get things, if we had the platoons on parade, they were in formation for a start, you know, and Sergeant Emerson would be at the head, and with 1 foot on the ground, he would say, "Prepare to mount! Mount!" And they mount, the other word of command was dismount. And I remember particularly this drill. We've got a photograph of the lot stationary.
That's the Imperial War Museum photograph.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And at first, of course, it was, I couldn't see his face. But later, when you brightened up, immediately it came to mind. God, there's no doubt, absolutely 100%
Did you remember anything about the troops that were assigned to the bikes, what they thought of the bikes?
And the whole business? They all thought it was great stuff, because they could all ride a bike. First of all, we had to find those who could ride a bike, but who can't ride a bike? But even though some can't. And I had to find somebody to maintain the bikes, and I was lucky enough to do that. And they were oiled regularly, the brake shoes were regularly inspected. And yes, they were well maintained, I must admit.
Were there any kind of crashes or like?
No, I can't remember. I was yawned, probably yawned, sort of tumble, but I can't remember anything like that happening or anybody being injured.
And that would be one platoon of D Company that would have the bikes, just the one platoon.
I rather think that, yes, we did form a motor, a cycle platoon. But there were more bikes than required for a platoon, I can assure you.
Now, during this period, the war diary talks about drafts being sent out to the Middle East, and
yes.
you were having drafts of recruits coming down from Brandsville at each stage. How did that affect how the battalion was being run?
I remember particularly, there was one Corporal Groves who was drafted. There was Sergeant Deacon who was drafted. He was later killed at a battalion Winchburg chap. There were quite a lot from nearly every company suddenly posted overseas. And they were reinforcements for the 6th, 8th and 9th. Years later, I was in Hoddesdon, and I moved to Hoddesdon in 1957, and I was having blocks born once in Hoddesdon, and there was a policeman. The country policeman looking after the trees and stuff in Broxbourne Woods, believe it or not, he had a bike, and he said, "Excuse me, I know you." And I looked at him and I said, "Good God, I know you as well." I said, "You were a corporal, Corporal Groves." He said, "That's right. From the local policeman up in Broxbourne Woods all these years later." And he was taken prisoner. And they told me of his adventures. But he was one of those posted to the 6th, 8th and 9th.
How many men would be drafted at a time?
Not very many. From the whole battalion, they'd probably send from time to time about a dozen. It would be probably on orders, you see. Yeah, they mentioned, on serious orders. It would be on the notice board.
What would the individual's reaction to that be? Did vary the reaction?
Well, mixed feelings. They didn't want to leave their loved ones for a start. They wanted to stay in England as long as possible for a start. They knew that we could have action someday, and we knew that as well. And we used to say, well, we won't be long, but they were going to the 8th Army and the Monty, the 6th, 8th, and 9th. And, so we wouldn't see them. We'd hear about them.
So one day they'd be there and the next they'd be gone.
Sorry?
One day they would be there and the next they'd be gone.
That's right. It would be mentioned on orders. Movements of every kind. When a soldier went into hospital, left the battalion, posted to other places or whatever, movements in and out of the battalion would always be promulgated and what's known as part two orders. I've got a copy of those part two orders somewhere.
And as they left, other men would be coming down from Brandsbeth and various other places.
Maybe they would come to us. That's right. Probably those in Brandsbeth wouldn't have had sufficient training for overseas. But they'd come to us and make up our numbers and get trained with us again sufficiently to go to us.
And you mentioned earlier that there was quite a high turnover of officers at this stage, officers that were there just
absolutely.
For a while and then...
Absolutely, all the time. I was amazed about the high turnover of the MT officer. The first one was a Captain McFeet. He was a dour Scot, he was. He must have been about 70 by the look of him. Captain McFeet. And he was the first one. Then he was replaced by somebody else.
Yes. So Captain McFeet, he was the first MT officer.
He was, and he was an old boy, and very old, grey-haired, but of course he was there to start us off with, I suppose, as the MTO, and then he left us, and there was another, somebody else, a short chap, came in his place, and then I've got to have some reminders, as a matter of fact, of the MTO in 1942. Yes. We took over the MT in 1942. Captain Cookson.
Mm.
Captain Cookson. I can remember him very well. MTO.
What was he like? We're looking at a list of 1942
right.
officers.
Well, then he didn't last. There was somebody else came after him. But anyway, in the anti-tank, Lieutenant Wyan. He was with us all through North Africa, but then I later, found out that he was in action. But all the officers here, they changed from the commander in 1942, the early part in Y was Major Balance. Well, he became the company commander of C Company later, and there's a new company commander for headquarters. I don't know if there's any good to order from him. But the second commander was Captain Kirkup. I remember him. He was good in action, incidentally. I remember Captain Kirkup was a Northern commander, and he was a very smart chap. And everything about him was action and smart. Yes. And then, surprisingly, the signals platoon was taken by Lieutenant Logan. And the mortars.
What happened to David Girling then? Because he was a man that...
Girling became the adjutant. He was promoted to captain by now. He was Captain Girling. And he was in the care of this Lieutenant Colonel Ware, MC, with Major Bannerman was second in command, and the adjutant, Captain Girling. So he became the adjutant.
Now,
And the intelligence officer, Lindley, Second Lieutenant Lindley. Well, he's because I know that he's been in many of the unions.
Now, while you're at Winchelsea, was there any kind of intercompany sports of any kind? I mean, did they have boxing and football, rugby, anything of that description?
No, there wasn't. There were the facilities there. I don't think there was a football field of any kind. There, even from marching and drill, we used in England. And there was no apart from swimming. When they marched off to go down to Campersands to have swimming sessions. As I said, we lost one chap, Corporal Price was drowned.
So you don't think the kind of sport was encouraged at this stage in the battalion? You don't think it wasn't encouraged?
No, not at that time at Winchelsea. Yeah. It was, we had PT only, early in the morning, and Sunday during the day, route marches, but sport, no.
What about RSM Thomason? He'd appeared on the scene now.
Yes, RSM Thomason appeared on the scene at Rye.
And because he had a reputation as a sportsman, didn't he?
At first, when he turned up, I rather think that he is a company sergeant major. I'm looking at this thing here.
So Thomason, memories of him, was he different to Pickering? Was he
absolutely different? He was. He was obviously a younger man. He was a smart, tall, typical regimental sergeant major. Although he came as a CSM first, and then he took over from Pickering. Pickering left, and he was the RSM. He was the new RSM. Enormous hands like bunches of bananas, and he appeared to have had something of a bash on the nose. So you could see that he had done some boxing, and he was really quite a nice chap, a smart chap.
How would he make his presence felt when you're at Winchelsea? Would he appear at any time, or would you just not see him?
Occasional village visit, and later, of course, we got to know each other very well indeed.
But what would he do when he came to Winchelsea? What would he be? What was his?
Well, he'd probably come in and look to see where the companies were. Probably have a word with the company star majors who had to keep in touch with him, George Broadhead and Arthur Pearson. And also he'd have a good eye for looking at the troops if they turn out and bailing and everything else, and he appeared to be very, very pleased.
So what would he do if he spotted somebody he didn't?
Well, he'd probably correct them. He'd probably correct their headgear and tell them to get their shoulders back and smarten up. You know, if anybody saw the answer, they'd take their hand off, they'd probably be sharpish. And they'd put on their best sort of be there.
What would happen if he didn't?
Well, he wasn't at least, but everybody in the Downs was trained to respect the royal officers. I'm pretty sure you're on that. Very respect. I must say, he was first class as well in battalion drill, where the battalion was on parade as well. You know, where the command excellent, everything under control.
You mentioned the headgear. Could you just explain that how the men would, what would they?
When we had forage caps, it was really essential for everybody in the Downright Infantry. In fact, it was called a privilege to have that forage cap right on the centre of your head, fore and aft, straight on fore and aft, not on a rakish angle. But some of the troops, of course, or outside in the evening and away from the battalion because of the girls. It did look a bit stupid, but it was looking a bit funny and old fashioned to have a hat dead on four and a half. We didn't most regimental kept it like that. But if they got away from the battalion, they put it on a rakish angle. But it was definitely one of the privileges, the DNI of Queen Victoria, apparently, instituted it, that she watched them marching, with their forage caps, because the forage caps were there years and years ago as well. And on the command about, if you turn right about sharpish, you lost your hat. It went to the ground. And so she picked up that hat and she went to the soldier and she put it on and she said, that's the way you must wear that hat from henceforth. The Downright Infantry, you would all wear your hats like that. And she did it, and this is what I've been told, this is why we wore it. It's delighted to privilege.
And so with the RSM and the CSMs, they would obviously spend a lot of time having to correct the men's headgear when you're out.
Absolutely. All these sergeants are selected in the Downs, in a 16th battalion anyway, they wore cheese cutters. They, when they promoted to a senior rank, they all had to hand in their FS cavalry service, and they wore their cheese cutters.
What's the cheese cutter? What's that?
It was just sort of the old, typical soldier's hat with a peak and a leather strap in the front and the badge. In fact, they made just bald. You know, wearing that cheese cutter, you could get the air to your head, and just a bit bald in a very short time. I mean, they were cheese